Thursday about House Bill 24. Well, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2613, and 2614 at this time, so that we can continue the conversation. Last Thursday, when we were concluding our last points, we had a couple people that, I don't know if everybody's in the room, but we had Chuck Bennett, Lori Wimmer Whalen, and Tricia Smith testifying. Do you want to see if they're out there? Thank you.
I think they were finished, but we might.
Well, we might want to ask them a question or two.
Yep, that's true.
Then what we'll do today is finish up everybody that had signed up last week, and then we have a couple additional people that signed up today. But Ms. Lori Wimmer Whalen, if you guys want to come forward, and Chuck and Tricia for your panel, and we kind of cut, we cut your conversation a little short, and I don't know if we had any follow-up questions today either. So I don't know if anybody wanted to, if you had any profound things that you thought more about this over the last 4 days, but any comments further about any of these bills?
Madam Chair, Tricia Smith, OSEA. For the record, are you open with 2614 as well?
No, not at this time.
All right.
We're just going to do the
12 and
14, yes.
Yes, 14 as well.
12, 13, and 14.
Well, then I guess I'll start with myself. I did not get an opportunity to speak to House Bill 2614.
Okay.
The other day when I was here before, and I want to let the committee know that while we haven't exactly come to a place of support for this bill, because we're a little concerned about creating yet another government bureaucracy to do what we should be doing anyway, I also don't know what the committee's intent with this bill is, so I want to offer you some suggestions for improvement if you decide to move something like this forward. The suggestions that I would like to offer is that the bill doesn't quite go far enough. If you're interested in investing in professional development as a significant method of improving student achievement, you've left out a significant part of the workforce in this bill. This bill deals with administrators and teachers, very important parts of the educational process. But when you're talking about at-risk students, special education students, Title I students, ESL students, all of the students that are on the bottom end of the achievement gap, you need to really include educational assistance in that professional development. Mm-hmm. Educational assistants, you may know, are the staff in schools today that provide the most one-on-one instruction of these children. And they are also the people in schools who receive the least amount of professional development that are currently instructing students. We suggest that you include them in every professional development proposal that you bring forward, because if you really want to help Title I kids, special ed kids, etc., all those kids that are required to achieve under No Child Left Behind and Oregon's standards, then you have to include the people that instruct them, and those are educational assistants. So that would be my suggestion for this and any other bill dealing with professional development. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Tricia. Any other comments on 2614? Well, we're going to... now, don't go. I was going to say, don't go too far in case we have questions here. Beth Ann, and if you will state your name for the record.
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm a government relations consultant for the Oregon Education Association. And I am here today to talk about the things that we do appreciate about House Bill 2614. We very much believe that having high standards for professional development is a very important goal that further work on how to share best practices and how to make research on professional development more widely available is also an important goal. And we appreciate Chalkboard's work at bringing this issue forward and making it a focus. We look forward to working with them to further discuss how best to implement the bill. I think we have concerns about creating an additional layer of bureaucracy, and we would, in this time when we're still looking for funding on many issues, we would like to figure out whether we can work within the additional within the parameters that we've already established, whether that's working with ESDs, whether that's working through the Department of Education, to further create some standards around professional development and make it more widely available. So we look forward to working with them, and you have my comments. I don't want to read them.
Okay.
Thank you. We would also join with OSEA in saying that we do believe that it's important that professional development apply to all educational employees, not just teachers and administrators.
And I'm going to add a little side comment, and bus drivers.
And bus drivers, everybody.
The first connection our children have frequently in the morning is the person that greets them, and I'll never forget because my mother and father both worked outside on the farm, and so I was the first adult I talked to every morning was my bus driver. And it was so nice when he said, "Good morning," he's always cheery. It's like, wow. So it does make a difference. Questions for this panel or anybody presented on this? Yes, Tricia.
Madam Chair, if I could just provide one bit of comment. First of all, I absolutely agree with you about school bus drivers, but I would tell you that school bus drivers actually get more mandated training than educational assistants do.
Right. And so, thank you for that clarification.
That was why I was focusing, since we're talking about student achievement here, on educational assistants. My first classified experience was with Mrs. Pruitt, my kindergarten school bus driver.
Exactly. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about primarily House Bill 2612. So if it's okay to move away from 2614
yes,
for a moment.
So long as somebody on this panel is comfortable with that.
I think so. Lori, you brought to our attention Senate Bill 318 and as perhaps an alternative to the 2612, and I'm trying to understand whether these are really in conflict. Here are the differences, two of the differences as I see them. Senate Bill 318 suggests a longer list of approved investments that schools could make in education. House Bill 2612 focuses on a narrower set. Senate Bill 318 also assumes that there is something like $300 million to invest in this longer list, whereas House Bill 2612, I think, is we heard testimony as assumes only about $40 million. If we had only the $40 million that Chalkboard is suggesting that we should use to make these investments, what do you think of their narrowed list? Is that the right place to start? Presumably, we can't do everything that you would like to do, and I would like to do, that's in the Senate bill that you've recommended to us. So how about that narrower list as focus priority?
Madam Chair and Representative Cannon, I think that's a wonderful question. Thank you for asking it. The first thing I would say is a reminder that this is already in statute, that longer list, that your predecessor colleagues had already passed, and it was based on consensus, bipartisan, bicameral, a lot of education stakeholders, a lot of experts from all over who came together and put it together. So you're tampering with existing law. Senate Bill 318 simply updated that list. The alternative throws it out and replaces it with a much smaller list. Now, to the point about money and choices, I don't think what I think of the list matters. I think what the school districts think of the list matters. And I'll give you a for instance. Their list would help K through 3 and 6 through 12. What about the 4th and 5th graders? Again, they're out of the bill.
Lori, since this is your first part of your
I'm sorry, Lori Wimmer Wayland, Oregon Education Association. I apologize, Madam Chair.
No, that's fine.
As I was saying, those seem to me to be some holes in their proposal, and I simply don't think that it's necessary to reinvent the wheel. In the absence of a convincing case that there's a problem to solve with respect to the current statute, which I didn't hear, it's simply a competing proposal, not necessarily a better one or a worse one. It's simply competing with existing law in a way that we believe doesn't take into account how 197 school districts have managed in the last 7 years with the $1.2 billion that was cut from their budgets over that period of time. And we just think that unless the legislature wants to be the super school board and mandate something or mandate a small list of some things, that it would be best to let the local elected officials and their administrators in the 197 school districts determine how what strategies are best for their students and also for the culture of their communities and so on.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, if I could just add to that, I think if you were going to narrow the list, as this bill suggests, that you don't have enough information yet. You would need to talk to those 197 school districts to determine which ones of them actually protected their early childhood reading programs and the other programs outlined in this bill and let go of other programs so that they could. Those school boards may appeal to you to provide an additional amount of money so that they are not spending, not beefing up something that they've already protected or beefed up on their own to the detriment of other major programs in their schools. So if you're going to reduce the list to this amount, then you need to make sure that districts haven't already seen that as where they needed to prioritize during this cut period.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can re-summarize what you just said, then, if it does come down to a dollar decision, your recommendation would still be keep the full list of programs and whatever dollar level gets aimed in that direction, that would be the choice of the districts to use whatever funds we provide.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, it's very hard for me to leap over the money. It's very hard for me. I'm not quite ready to go there
all right,
yet.
All right.
But I would say that absolutely the list that we have in statute as restated in Senate Bill 318 is indeed what we believe to be the opportunity for school districts to target additional funds in the areas of student achievement where they feel their district needs that help.
Thank you.
I feel the need to make a comment. When I was principal of the school and my school had not met adequate yearly progress, we had to write a comprehensive school reform plan. And that's more pages than what we even see in the legislature. And what you find very quickly is you can't use the Heinz 57 model. You have to figure out what you're doing well and do it really well. And what all the great, and I'm going to use that term, innovative concepts are wonderful. But until you really narrow the field and really think about how you're using your money and using best practices as your delineator, we can spin our wheels for another 20 years here in education and still have almost a third of our children dropping out. That's a concern. And so however we get there, and what's already in statute, I'm not, you know, I appreciate the reminder of all of the work of our four fathers and sisters and mothers here. But there is something to be said about, you know, where is our focus going to be? And that would be my only comment. It's sometimes very hard when you have every option available. So,
Madam Chair, might I respond to that?
Absolutely.
I couldn't agree more that the strategies need to be tailored, focused, specific, and based on best practices. But I would simply suggest to you that a top-down approach can't possibly divine what's going to be the single thing that's best for a school with a lot of ELL kids versus a school where they have a high dropout rate, but not that particular problem, something else is going on. And that's for the local school to decide.
Well, and I don't disagree with you there, because if I thought a top-down answer would take care of it, would be done and gone. and so, but I do have high respect for what Tricia said, and it is. It is up to the local districts. But we face this whole situation, no matter what the topic is, whether it's health care or anything else. I mean, I'd love to have every person in the state fully covered in health care. I mean, that was the dream of Governor Kitzhaber, but there's limits. So go ahead,
Chair,
and then I'll get off my...
Well, I'm going to join you on your whatever platform you're on. My name is Otto Schell. I'm the Vice President for Legislation with the Oregon PTA. We have a really compelling recent example of how this could work, because when the ITACs passed in Multnomah County, there was a committee set up to oversee what was done with the money. Nobody told the districts that you could only do these things or that you had to choose from this, but different districts did different things, and Representative Minnis and Representative Cannon can tell you that their districts got different treatments for different needs, and the performance improved. You can go to the SEAC report. I regret that it's the one thing I don't carry around in my bag today, because you can see the documentation of when the money was applied to the different things that the different districts thought was applicable. They got the performance. They got lower dropout rates, improved reading scores, improved math scores. Now, this was over a three-year period. It gave them stability. It gave them a decent amount of money for the size of population, and it was spread out evenly over all those districts, and they got results. And I think that's what we're trying to suggest with the menu that we've suggested. We do trust the districts to know what's right for their district and the communities to rally around those things and make them go. And the SEAC report, which I will get for you. It's online. It's available to the world. And it was a committee made up of business people from many different representatives on that oversaw the distribution and the reporting. I think it's a really compelling, fairly current example of how this could work. So,
thank you. Where were we? Cindy Robert. And where's Michael? How does he sit on this? Is Michael Shields here? He was here the other day. Cindy, you want to come on up? It says Cindy Robert.
From last week.
From last week?
She's probably here by now.
Yes, no?
She'll wait till the end.
Madam Chair, Sue and I want to wait till the end.
Oh, okay.
For the chair from last week's request.
I appreciate that clarification. Okay.
Share communication.
Well, it's using the sign-up sheets from last week that are overlaid on this week.
Michael Roberts or Chuck.
Okay. Michael Shields or Chuck Hebra? Yeah, that's it.
Sorry.
I'm glad you're here, Chuck.
I didn't do well in penmanship in school.
Michael Shields isn't here.
So Michael Shields is not here today. Okay, thank you. Well, thanks for helping me get through that, Chuck.
My pleasure. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audit Division. And thank you for taking just a moment to let us talk a little bit about Bill 2613. I do have written testimony that we passed around, and I promise to stay very close to the script so I can talk and be out of your way, because you've got other things to do. But regarding House Bill 2613, the Secretary of State's office and the Audit Division really doesn't have a position on the substance of the bill. We do have one observation and then one technical issue with the bill that we would like to get your help with, and I'll get into that as we go through. But really our observation is that, as we've stated on numerous occasions, our office is interested in being able to do performance, independent performance audits of school districts and education service districts. And this bill does not provide for independent performance audits. We would ask that you support Senate Bill 47 for that reason. Senate Bill 47, which should be coming to you shortly, establishes best practices for school districts and does allow for independent audits by our division. So if you just consider that as you're considering this bill, we would appreciate that. The one technical issue we did have with House Bill 2613 is on page 2, line 13, which is in section 31B, which asks the Secretary of State to appoint a member of the Financial Management Advisory Committee. And though we certainly are flattered by that opportunity, that does cause us some problems with the Secretary of State being the role of Auditor of Public Accounts. In brief, being a part of that advisory committee would cause independence problems for us. Our auditing standards would not allow us to participate in management decisions of that nature and also be an independent auditor. So if you could see your way clear to audit that particular line out of the bill, that would be very helpful to us. And that is the extent of my testimony. Thank you very much for the moment.
Yes, well, thank you, Chuck. Questions from the panel? Representative Minnis.
Could you speak to the notion of voluntary versus mandatory audits? And what is the success or failure of either?
Chair Kopp, Representative Minnis, you're talking about the provision in Senate Bill 47 that allowed for voluntary.
Correct.
I guess time will tell. You know, my particular position on it I'd rather have the Senate Bill 71 that we put forward this time and also have done in the past.
Which said?
Which would be mandatory. It funds us to do performance audits of school districts. Would be our preference, but this is something that was negotiated with Senate Bill 47 and Senator Walker's committee, and it could work fine. I mean, you just don't know. It is voluntary. There are some incentives for school districts to sign up if they do. My understanding of the bill, and you'll certainly get a chance to look at it as it comes forward, is that if they participate in a voluntary way, then the audit itself is paid for. With state school funds before they're distributed. So this district is not bearing directly the cost of that audit. That would come from money that's set aside from the state school fund to pay specifically for those audit activities. So to volunteer, you'd in effect not be paying directly for the audit costs.
If follow up, please. If someone's having difficulty, is it likely they're going to come forward and say, please audit me? Is that really a practical?
Representative Comp, Chair Comp, Representative Minnis, we have that happen. I mean, we do have agencies in the state now who do ask for our help when they run into problems. We just got a request from Department of Corrections to come in and help with their controls. So, you know, it happens.
Go figure.
You know, it certainly does happen, and I think entities that are used to being auditing and understanding what it is that we do and can provide are probably more comfortable with that. Those that aren't, I would think, would be hesitant, but you know, only our charm, I guess, will tell.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem?
Yes, let me pursue some things. With an audit, what you do in a performance audit is hold the template of expectation against performance. Do I understand that correctly?
Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, that can be one aspect of it. We certainly are always searching for good criteria, and I think that's what you're talking about, comparing a criterion like best practices to actual practices. A performance audit oftentimes will go deeper than that in looking for economies and efficiencies and maybe the results of not following best practices, if that is indeed what the focus of the audit is. So it can be deeper than that.
Having heard testimony from you on a performance audit and being singularly impressed with the work you did, what I'm trying to show for the committee is the myriad of standards that your performance audit held a group to. And then where I'm going with this, having been a superintendent, is I know that when it was time annually for us to have a financial audit, we brought our affairs in order, and we certainly wanted the auditor to look at everything. But where I'm going with this is, with a performance audit, if I knew it was coming every year, would I bring my performance and my affairs in order if I knew it was coming every year?
Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, I would have to hope so. I mean, we think that part of what we do is not just for accountability purposes, but also to influence activities.
So then I could say then that a mandated annual audit would give at least some notion that a school was meeting at least the standards they were being audited against.
Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, I think from that point of view, you may be right. I think it also may be costly, and at certain point, there may be a diminishing return having a performance audit done that often. They do the financial audits every year because they need an attestation as to the financial statements that they are right. Performance is a little different issue. We tend not to audit the same entity year after year after year. But you know, given the right set of circumstances, I could see a...
Does your department do any financial audits?
Yes, sir.
Then let me ask you this. Let me go here. I know that in my time as a superintendent, I always found that I could use that audit money for something better. Do you ever find that when you audit people that they proclaim loudly that you're not, and you really, some most years don't find very much, but that they could use that audit money in a better way?
Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, never.
Thank you.
Of course,
good
I did.
Answer.
From our point of view, an audit is about answering a question, and the question could be yes, no, maybe so. And if the question is right, or the financial statement's really something you're interested in getting an attestation about, then that's what you're buying. And that's.
Yeah. And here comes the softball. when an agency is audited, does it improve their performance?
Representative Comp, Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, I believe so. You know, we do track recommendations we make and the number that are implemented, and we go to the extent to say if they were implemented, what that would generate in terms of savings or improved controls. Or
when you give them the audit sheet and an agency goes down the list of your recommendations and they don't implement those recommendations, what happens to them?
Chair Comp, Representative Dallum, there's a couple accountability measures. We do follow up on them, so certainly we hope the pestering eventually will take its toll, and we certainly track that and report that. It also is something that's included in their budget document to you folks as part of Ways and Means, is things that have been recommended and the status of those recommendations. So that provides an opportunity for the legislature to hold them accountable for those recommendations as well. In terms of the power we have, you know, it's the power of the pen. You know, we don't have any police authority here, so.
I would close by saying thank you. I know that in the public sector, your audits were very welcome because they did keep us on the straight and narrow and doing the things that this agency had paid for. And I think you've demonstrated that very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin and then Representative Bissonnette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a question actually to the committee here as well as to our Senate Bill 47.
Yes, sir.
Was sent to Ways and Means, and I believe, and therefore really doesn't have to come back to here. I mean, it can go directly to the floor. So I don't know, is there anybody here on Ways and Means? I'm not thinking that there is anybody here.
No.
So, I mean, I would hope that our committee chair would talk to people on Ways and Means to ask some of those questions or to see about whether it could come here and those kinds of things if we want to have those discussions, just so the discussion happens. Because I agree with you. I think the discussion has been really good, and having those discussions about whether it's a required or a not required audit would be kind of a good thing. And I appreciate hearing your testimony.
Thank you.
I mean, annual, I think you have to do that for the financial part. Performance audits, I don't think you would go to annual. Everyone.
I
don't think there's enough. I don't think we have the people or the whatever for that, or the money. But I do think that knowing it's coming lets people look at themselves and ask their neighbors again what they're doing to see if they could do it better. I think any time we do that and set that up, it causes people to have that communication with the other person and to talk to their organizations, whether it's COSA or whatever, and say, have you found ideas that really work here and there, or the PTAs? When they know it's coming, they look around and say, hey, we'd like to be doing things that are right, and they get good information from all those other eight groups. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hubner. Explain to me, I have two questions. Explain to me what you mean by...
Representative, you know how to count to two. Representative Dahl doesn't.
You,
thank you for your patience.
Explain, why do you say independent performance audit versus a performance audit? What's...
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnett, internal auditors do a lot of the same sort of things. And so within an organization, you can still do the sort of activities that could be considered a performance audit. And oftentimes they do, like Department of Transportation does do performance audits that, sorry about that, the performance audits that that meet standards, and but they're internal to the organization. The independence is getting someone like ourselves that's outside the organization and independent to provide the same sort of attestation and the information in a way that it can be viewed as completely independent.
So I have to, clarification, then the other question.
you just go right ahead.
So you're using the word independent to mean someone not within the school system, someone outside the school system.
Correct.
Okay. All right. The second question is that the way I understood the bill, and I'm a signatory, and a lot of people on this up here are signatures on the 2613, and I'm a big supporter of performance audits, but they're very costly. And what we were looking for here in this bill was a way to look at best practices and be sure that we can, you know, be sure that we're doing the best, you know, the way the thing says in the summary, that we're doing payroll and all of those things to find efficiencies that we can put in the classroom for teachers and for students. So I don't understand why you, you know, because financial audits are serve good purposes like that, and maybe even that should be financial and looking at performance or best practices. So I don't understand why you would be opposed to that. If we're looking for ways to put more money in the classroom for teachers and children.
Chair Comp, Representative Wisdom, I think that you probably got to the heart of the reason why we aren't opposed to the concepts of this bill, of best practices, and that's why we're kind of leaving it up to you folks and others in the education community to decide what it is that school districts need or ESDs need in terms of best practices. If the school districts and ESDs want somebody to help them put best practice in place, then I would think we'd be all for that. It's just that our role would be different. I mean, we wouldn't be necessarily providing best practices and helping them instill it like in a managerial way, but the auditor would come in after the fact and be able to test that, yes, you know, the best practices are in place, that they're realizing the savings, or no, they aren't. So the sort of activities you're contemplating in the bill, okay, fine. You know, if that's what the districts think they need, then great. But an audit function would be able to stand outside of that whole activity and come up with some sort of definitive description of what's really happening in those entities. And that I think that's probably the distinction I would make.
Okay, it's not a question. It's a comment to the chair.
I'm listening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think, I mean, this is what, when I signed on to this bill, and I hope the people up here sign on this bill, we were not looking at we were looking for ways that they were going to go out and do. In the military, we used to call it crosstail. You go to one unit and see what that unit's doing, and you implement it somewhere else, and maybe result in a cost savings. And if I had another question, I'd probably ask the representative from the Audits Division of Secretary of State of it also, because I think the transportation grant still needs to be looked at and the practices of how we're doing transportation. That's a big cost. And I appreciate Mrs. Smith's comments about, you know, they're doing it best. But I think we need to still look at that. I have several letters. I think this committee had a letter from the city of Redmond endorsing trying to look for transportation. I know the city of Bend looked at trying to use school buses and for our transportation needs in Bend as it grew, and the same thing would happen there. So not a question.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hibner, just to clarify, when you mentioned the negotiations over the mandate issue, that was negotiations with the Senate, not with any of the House committees, correct?
Representative Buckley, that'd be correct.
Just to clarify that. I just wanted to ask a couple of, if you had a place in auditing heaven, would you mentioned performance audits not on an annual basis, but what kind of basis? Every 4 years, every 5 years? What would be your magic word?
Representative Comp, Chair Comp, Representative Buckley.
Yeah.
The sort of work we do on the performance audit side is risk-based. We truly try to consider the universe of things that should be audited and entities that should be audited, triage it, devote our resources the best we can to try to cover those things. So to be able to come up with a specific schedule for auditing a specific subject matter in a specific district, or even, you know, district or total, you know, specific district or the width of all the school districts or ESDs, thank you, is difficult to say. I don't know that there would be a set schedule that would necessarily apply. Annually does seem a little too often based on the sort of work that we do when we do performance audits and looking at similar operational issues in state agencies regularly. You'd be looking at the same sort of issues in school districts and thinking that those would need to be reviewed annually is hard for me to get my mind around, but there may be situations where that might truly be the case.
Mm-hmm. I bring this up. The training.
I didn't list how many questions, Chad, so go right ahead.
I'll ask if I can use one of the Representative Dahlem's questions.
There you go.
The training program that I worked with, we had a performance audit on a 5-year cycle, and depending on how that audit went, you might get 10 years after the five. After 5 years, if you really hit the nail on the head. But part of it had to do with what Reverend Wisnett was talking about in terms of this bill. As part of that process, we did get information what other programs similar to ours were doing that actually would help us improve our performance. And on the accountability, and I guess I don't know if it's a question or not, but on the accountability scale on this, isn't it true that the school board would be the entity that would keep the school accountable once they receive the performance audit of what their district is doing?
Chair Kopp, Representative Buckley, they would be the auditee in this instance. So all the recommendations, everything would go back to the district board.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just have one quick question. I've been, part of an audit before, but it was only a deficiency audit. The goal of the auditors coming in was to find our weaknesses. Mm-hmm. When you do an audit, are you looking for strengths and weaknesses? So that, we can learn from other districts?
Yeah, Chair Kopp, I think that would probably be very, very good to do in this case, because a lot of the value of any audit of this type, where you're talking about 198 school districts in ESDs, though you only may be looking at one, when you release the report, I would suspect all the entities would be looking at that report to try to find what it is, if their other folks are doing well or not doing well, and how they might be able to apply those sorts of things. So that certainly would be something we would consider, is to give best practices as they're applied and also the sorts of things that need to be improved.
Because frequently audits do show deficiencies, and they.
Chair Kopp, I'm afraid that's the nature of the business, but when we can show balance and those sorts of things, we try to.
Yeah, but it would be nice to find the things we do really well. Mm-hmm. Representative Minnis.
I just wanted to note that it was interesting when we started talking about audits, everybody kind of shivered up here. It doesn't seem to be something that people are comfortable with. But oftentimes I've found that when there's a good audit, that really does build a lot of confidence, and mm-hmm. when school districts are doing something well, and there is an independent source that can cite that, then it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this can play either way. It'll help them strengthen their weaknesses, but also it can say to the public, they're doing a good job. So I think there's a balance in all of that, and I think an outside audit function would be a good way to go.
Chair Kopp, President, I would agree. And, like I said before, a good question is a good question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's good, bad, or somewhere in between.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your brief moment was very informative. Thank you, Mr. Hibner.
You bet.
Is Art Anderson or Mickey Oden here from last Thursday? They had signed up. Okay. Thank you. We're now on today's list. Mrs. Dials, Marilyn, do you want to come forward? Okay. And Marilyn, I probably said your name wrong again, but
that's all right.
But you can say it right.
I forgive you.
Okay.
My name is Marilyn Dillis.
Dillis.
It's a Greek name, and everything is soft in Greece.
Oh.
The soft I.
Okay.
D. Philes. There is no D, really. Should be if we were in Greece, it would be pronounced Philes. I'm up from California. I've been in Oregon 10 years. My background is I've been a teacher of primary grades really kindergarten, for 4 separate years. And I taught all over the country, 1 year at a time. The first year I taught, I started a kindergarten on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, and I had absolutely no experience. That was an interesting year. I caught mumps from my children. It was disastrous and wonderful. The second year, I taught on the San Francisco Peninsula. I had 75 children. I had 37 in the morning session of kindergarten and 38 in the afternoon session, and I don't know how I survived that, except I was young right in those days. Third year I taught on the Lower East Side in New York City. I taught Spanish children up from Puerto Rico, and so I found myself teaching kindergarten to English as a second language. Mira, look at me. Third year, I taught in San Luis Obispo County, and I taught children from the area where they could see the ocean, and they grew strawberries, and it was rural. It was a lovely community. And then 10 years and 3 children later, and a marriage, of course, I went back and got my library credential and master's in librarianship at San Jose State, and I've spent almost 3 years being a children's librarian. So I'm trying to say to you some things about children. Class loads are very important. It's very important for you to get down, especially first grade. Kindergarten, yes, it's important to get kindergarten down, too, because you do a lot of beginning routines, how to get along together, how we settle arguments, not by hitting each other, but by talking it out, what it is, and so forth and so on. I had a wonderful background in child development. I think some things bother me in some of these bills on 2612. Student achievement. It sounds like we're trying to make a beautiful piece of furniture, but children are not furniture. They're living, growing, changing, immature human beings, and we need to treat them with affection, and we need to give them a lot of approval, and we need to respect them, even though they make a lot of mistakes. They use their erasers a lot in those early grades. And we need to honor them, really, as human beings that are changing, and we need to let them grow and change. They are not things, and they're not going to be perfect. They're learning all the time if you're doing a good job with them. So it bothers me that you're going to have student achievement. No, that isn't really what you want. I like it better. School improvement, yes, because the teachers need to help them learn, is what you're saying to me. There's a big difference. They're not things, and they never will be perfect, because I'm not perfect. Are you perfect? I don't think so. None of us are perfect. I have trouble with, on page 2 of 2612, I have trouble with line 12. The department may not award a grant under this section directly to a public charter school. Do you know something about charter schools? Because we are trying to get one into Corvallis. Corvallis closed last June the finest elementary school in the whole district. There are 9 elementary schools, and by darn, they closed the best one. It was in the country. It had space around it. It had trees around it. It had a little stream near it. They were growing Christmas trees and various farm things. And it was truly a community school. There were no 7-Elevens. There was no church out there. We were about, I don't live there. My children do. So I have grandchildren there. There were about, we were about 10 miles out of Corvallis.
Maryland.
All there was a school.
Maryland, it would really help us if you could get focused on the schools.
All right. So, no. Now we are trying to make a charter school of it. And, yes, it needs a grant directly to the charter school. And instead, in line 14, a school district that receives a grant under this section may transfer? No, it shall transfer a portion of the grant based on the school. By those terms, you are pinpointing it as some kind of the charter, as some kind of an orphan child or with secondary stature. And also, the thing I gave you last Thursday was to ask for the charter school teachers to have at least 95% of a full salary, and 100% should be better, because they are cutting edge. They are cutting edge. They're trying different things. And they're risk takers when they want to try this. My two son and daughter-in-law both teach at OSU and Earth Sciences. And we want to make it a science school so that children have early science day after day after day in the open air. If they can get outside and learn about stream ecology, it would be an environmental school. It would be a wonderful school, and we're missing it by one vote on the school board. So that's where we are. On line 17 and 18, a public charter school that received grants shall use the funds for the activities specified in the plan submitted by the school. Again, the charter school will be run by largely parents who are educated themselves and want a good science, beginning science school. And so they need some leeway there. They need some independence there. That needs to be reworked. I don't know quite how. I am disappointed that it doesn't go far enough. On line 35, every 15 to 17 students, we are trying to start our school with not more than 20 children in each class, no matter what. And 15 to 17, that's fine. But it should go through second and third grade. I want to remind you that some boys, especially, boys are not nearly as verbal, and they're not nearly as emotionally wired together as girls are. They're not as quick to learn reading as boys, as girls are. And some boys don't catch on to reading till the third grade. Isn't that right?
Yes, there's always exceptions to every rule.
That's right. I think those small classes, you need to keep planning so that you give them to second and third grades also. House Bill 2613, in our district, the person who does the books, the bookkeeper, the money manager, is very powerful. She tells the school board and the superintendent how much money they will have. Can they get this charter school through? Or can they? Just think about that. Do you really want to give that much power to the person who cooks the books? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. 2614, my only think on that is, do you want another layer of bureaucracy and more? It looks pretty incestuous to me. You're piling on administration upon administration upon administration. Where are the common people in this? There's not one common person here. They're all administrators. Is that really what you want? I'd like to recommend this book to you. I don't know whether you know it or not. It's called The Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. This book is done by a man who lives in San Diego, and he's made a big effort to get his two boys out in the woods. He says children need space around them and forest and streams, and they need to see the sky and so forth and so on. This is a great book. The other thing I wanted to comment on was last Thursday, the Chalkport people said there isn't very much research on education. I beg to differ. There's a lot of research. It's usually gathering dust in teacher training institutions. You go to Lewis and Clark. They teach a law. They teach young people to be teachers. Lots of theses, lots of master's theses. They have attacked problems. Go and brush off the dust on some of those. The same with OSU. And you know where they're training teachers better than I do in Oregon. I would like to close by reminding all of you, if you didn't turn on the television or you were busy this weekend, that all the governors of all the states gathered in Washington, D.C. this weekend to talk about problems and how to solve them. The number one frustration was public education of their citizens. Why were there so much obesity in young children? Why were there so many high school dropouts? Sound familiar? Why were so many students not going on to college? Sounds familiar? So you have a lot of work for you. And one governor talked about how you have to take risks. That's what charter schools do. They take risks. They're trying out something. OSU is going to be a great space for tapping students to come out and learn how to teach whatever better, how to teach hydrology better. There's that stream out there. We're going to have a great school. One more vote. That's all I have.
Well, Mrs. Dillis, I just want to thank you.
You're welcome.
It's obvious you are very well read. And I understand why you're a librarian. And your attention to detail on our bills is refreshing. And I just thank you for your time.
You're welcome. And try this book. It's by Richard Louv. I may be murdering that word, too. His last name is Louv. It's in paperback now. It came out in 2005. And it has a lot of stuff about children, a lot of research on the children and why they need to be out of doors a lot.
Thank
Great
you.
Book.
Thank you for your advocacy.
Yeah, anybody want to ask me anything?
Good question. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
We have two last people to testify that signed up, David Foster and Susan Farmer. Would you mind coming to the witness table together? Yes?
Foot.
Okay. It's David Foot. Thank you. And if you would, when you identify yourself, if you would refer to which bill you're testifying to, please.
Chair Comp, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity this afternoon to come before you and provide testimony on House Bill 2613, focusing on Section 26 and dealing with pupil transportation. My name is David Foote. I'm a resident of Redmond, Oregon. Mayor Unger today sends his regrets that he couldn't join you. He says he had not a higher calling, just a different one. He's delivering the State of the City address today. But he will be here tomorrow, and should you wish to talk with him or other mayors from Central Oregon about this, he's more than happy to make himself available to discuss it with you. For the past 6 months, a consortium of private leaders, community leaders, business leaders, and local leaders of jurisdictions have been meeting to basically address the question of expanding transportation options for Central Oregon, realizing the critical nature of that to sustain the livability, the economic viability of the region. And one of the keys underlying all of that really is focusing on education and making sure that the opportunities for learning are expanded, because that truly is the bedrock of many of the really critical elements that sustain, support, and enhance the viability of the region. It's in that context that the consortium council has support HB 2613 and is doing it with two objectives in mind. One is providing more resources for the classroom and meeting the ever-expanding student transportation requirements. And we don't see those as antithetical, but see those as both highly important objectives to attain. I'm sort of struck today when I walk back into this building, realizing that it's been a number of years ago that I was here doing research for a certain gentleman by the name of Travis Cross, and working with a former member of this body, Representative then Congressman John Dellenbach, and realizing that that took me to not only here but then to Washington State to work with Dan Evans, and then to Colorado to work with Dick Lamb, Governor Dick Lamb, where I was director of the Office of Planning and Budgeting. So it's sort of interesting to come back to the roots of all of that. And it's also interesting to come back to the roots and talk about the subject, given that while I was at Willamette to put myself through school, I drove a school bus. So it all seems to come back home. But driving a school bus back when I was doing it and when probably most of us were going to school is far different than the demands of student transportation today. And as you begin to take a look at the need for providing more educational opportunities, more learning opportunities, you quickly realize that transportation is an integral part of providing the mobility and access to those services, and that those are beginning to explode. You take a look at special education, you take a look at school choice, take a look at charter schools, you take a look at work-related learning, take a look at changing what is probably going to occur in terms of grades 10 to 14 in terms of the patterns of change that are going to be there and requiring different types of service, and taking a look at the whole concept of continuous learning and what implications of that for mobility services. So when you begin to take a look at all of that, it begins to raise a fundamental question, and that is the traditional homeschool transport system the most effective, efficient, and equitable way to meet the growing demands of more diverse transport requirements to optimize student learning? And this brought home really in a very concrete example to me by Superintendent Ted Thonstad of Sisters when he said, in essence, why wouldn't we welcome a neighboring school district to develop a center of excellence that our students could attend? And thus allowing us not to have to spend money to recreate that, or and being able to put that into a better use. And he closed that by saying, you know, the real key to this is transportation. So it doesn't take much to recognize that you know, patterns have changed. And this includes more flexible patterns of service. It involves more movement of smaller numbers of students at any given time. So as you begin to look at this and look at the existing law, the fundamental question is, does this provide the necessary incentives for innovation that are really going to be required in the future for transportation services to meet learning opportunities? It's known by Steve Swisher, superintendent of Crook County. It doesn't provide those kind of incentives, and he welcomes an opportunity to see legislation that would. And I think in testimony that was presented last week by Mayor Unger, his comment is referenced in that, and it's also included in the document that you got today from me. So the question about developing services that meet these opportunities is really not a question of efficiency. And I think oftentimes we've talked about 2613 in terms of this bill as being a question about how do you improve efficiency. And we would argue that it really is to improve innovation and to offer the opportunities for innovation. And that the innovation really means how do you more effectively provide services that also are efficient and equitable. And to that end, we definitely believe that 2613 provides incentive, provides flexibility for school districts as well as community to work in harmony to begin to answer the fundamental question of what is the most efficient, effective, and equitable system for providing services. I think we would make one suggestion of 2613, and that is to add a factor for mileage that isn't in the formula under Section 26 sub 2, as especially in rural districts and districts which are in growth mode, where you might find students that are living further away from a core that need to be transported, the mileage factor probably should be taken into consideration. I'm sure you've been told that school districts are already operating about as efficiently as they can in terms of student transportation. I would agree that statement is mostly true if you accept the existing school transportation paradigm is the most appropriate to meet the existing emerging student transportation demands. We see the real challenge is not trying to make the existing system more efficient. The challenge is to develop innovative changes to evolve the current paradigm to one that is more effectively as well as efficiently and equitably addresses the changes in education. Student transportation must be a servant of the interests of education and not an albatross. Finally, in a testimony last week, you had it was noted about the Washington State K-12 Pupil Transportation Funding Study. It was noted one of the conclusions was that nationally there is no best practices in funding methods, but there are in operating practices. So the immediate question is why? And the study proposes an answer to that, which is best practices and funding methods do not exist because each state's method reflects its unique political, financial, and operational climate, as well as its own goals for funding transportation. Consortium encourages the passage of 2613 because it provides a clear way for this body to assess that optimum way for funding transportation to meet the educational goals, not the transportation goals, of what you want to have accomplished. And in the interim, the block grant approach provides an opportunity for innovative communities and school districts to begin the process of finding exciting and unique ways to expand educational opportunities, saving money, and expanding opportunities at the same time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Any questions for Mr. Foote? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foote, thank you for your testimony, and I very much appreciate you bringing the idea of innovation into this rather than efficiencies, because it does put us on a different path. Do you have any examples in mind? Again, we have to get kids to school. That's a given. We have to. Would you agree? Can I ask a couple questions here?
Yes, sir.
Would you agree that the mandate to get kids to school is something that the state should continue to?
It's essential.
Absolutely. Thank you. And then the second question I'd have is, can you give some examples then of, in addition to
to completing that mandate, our obligation, what sort of examples would you be suggesting that a block grant might be able to do in addition to make sure that transport to home and back happens?
One of the things that you could begin to take a look at is enhanced use of the asset. You've got an asset that right now is probably, what, maybe 40% of the time used?
Right.
And so innovation in terms of how you better use that asset, how you probably design that asset so that it is more usable for more populations, so that you don't necessarily segregate populations where they don't need to be segregated, is one very simple example of that. You already have patterns of that, which are sort of reverse in Portland and Eugene, where high school students basically ride public transit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that we haven't thought, especially in smaller communities, that the largest fleet of public transportation, which is the school bus, hasn't been used for other populations? And I know that all of us are going to sit there and say, no, we've ridden the school bus as a superintendent or as the principal, and we're going out there, and we're not going to do that again. but we also realize that the design of that vehicle can be dramatically changed to accommodate a variety of different populations. And so why aren't we using that asset a lot more vigorously? And that's a question that the communities in Central Oregon are beginning to ask and beginning to have a dialogue about how they can improve that. I'd also say that traditionally what we have done is built significant barriers to keep the existing system in place.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I think we really have to start taking a hard look at, and it's not going to happen overnight, it's going to take 3 to 5, 6 years, is how we decrease the barriers to meet the effectiveness criteria that we want, rather than trying to keep the same system in place.
Thank you. Just to comment back, in my county, we have such an incredible problem right now with the transportation for seniors. And I would love to try to come up with an innovative way that we could use the resources that we have to make sure our senior population also has access to transportation.
If nothing else, just to get them from North Bend to Coos Bay.
Yep, I'd agree.
Different district.
Thank you so much, Mr. Foote. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank you.
Very good.
Susan Farmer, if you would recognize, say who you are and what bill you're addressing today.
Chair Comp representatives, my name is Susan Farmer. I am testifying today in regards to House Bill 2612. There is a very specific portion of that bill that concerns me greatly, and that is Section 3, Paragraph B, lines 36 through 41. I just became aware of this particular bill on Friday, so I have had to very speedily listen to the testimony that was done last week and try to prepare my own. I was quite surprised by the bill. And I appreciate the Chalkboard Project for mentioning that they are very open to solving the same goal that I think most of us in the state of Oregon have, and that is to use what is proven, what research has proven to work for children. And that is the goal that I have and what my testimony is in regards to. I was very excited when I listened to some of the testimony. Lots of times when I talk about research-based education, I find that I'm coming up against people who have never heard the terminology, and I was excited to hear terms in the testimony like data-driven instruction and research-based education. So it was very exciting to be able to hear that there's a knowledge base already on the committee. There are portions of the testimony, however, that very much concerned me. One of the things that was stated in the testimony last Thursday, I believe it was, is that that we do not have a long history of research. Actually, quite the opposite is true. The statement was made that we don't research K through 12 education in the same way that we do other areas. Actually, that is also false. Scientific research-based education has been existing in this country for many, many years. In fact, in I believe it was 1997. Let me look really quick here. It was 1997. Congress appointed a panel that is termed the National Reading Panel because they were very, very concerned over the test scores and the fact that there is an illiteracy epidemic in this nation. So they requested on behalf of the Child Health and Human Development to research the research. The National Reading Panel was formed to do exactly that task. It was established and told to come back and state what makes a reader. In their research, they researched over 100,000 reading research projects. Out of those 100,000, they determined which ones were indeed that met what would be termed scientific research-based research that met the criteria, peer-reviewed. I have a little booklet. I won't get into the many criteria of scientific research-based instruction, but we also, right here, another statement that was made was that Oregon should have a research center in education, and nationally we were disappointed in what we found. We only found about a half a dozen research things that had been going on as the information. The University of Oregon has been conducting reading research right in our own backyard for many, many years. Right now they are in the process of many federal projects and grants that have been submitted. Deborah Simmons down there is working on three federal research projects in reading and instruction right now, and also in professional development. So there is a lot going on right here in Oregon that has proven. We have a research center right here in Oregon. There is another one in Florida. And these research centers in Florida is Joseph Torgerson. There are lots and lots of people, Louisa Motes, Catherine Snow, who have done tons of research. So there is no lack of what is proven to work for children. One of the most familiar of among the education field is a project called Optimize that was done here in the state of Oregon. And they took the bottom 25th percentile of children to tested very, very specific tests, one of which was the Woodcock-Johnson reading mastery test, Woodcock reading mastery, and lots of other different tests. And they took the bottom 25th percentile, and by the end of kindergarten, all children exceeded benchmarks. So given the right instruction, children will achieve if you intervene with the correct type of instruction immediately. One of the things that I'm very concerned about is the fact that the chalkboard has designated the SMART project to be one of the criteria for tutors. I would like to go over the very first page of the handout that you have states exactly what kind of research has been done with the SMART project, and I would like to highlight a little bit of that. First of all, the SMART volunteers receive 1 to 2 hours of training. They get Introduction to Reading Strategies, and that is it. They have had no instruction on how to teach children to read. It says that that there were sizable positive impacts on student reading ability. I went and looked at the research study that was done over the weekend, and there on page 2, it states that a randomized controlled trial of 127 at-risk students were taken in this study. First of all, there is no indication in this information, and I do have the website at the bottom of the page where I got this information, that states the criteria they used to pull out these children. How are they determining that these children were at risk, and what percentile were they? They also state that they used only one type of intervention, and that was their own. In other words, they did not compare their intervention with another intervention. I have no doubts. I don't think anybody has a doubt that reading aloud to children helps. What is the concern is that there is no control group of doing a different type of intervention and showing, okay, which one works better. And so at the two-year follow-up, it's very interesting in the two bullets on that page 2 that children were still scoring at the 29th percentile after 2 years. First of all, that speaks very poorly of the classroom instruction if they're still at the 29th percentile. That's failing. And so to go, and that's an average score. It's average, which means half the children were below that. It says the average SMART group student scored in the 29th percentile after 2 years of their so-called intervention, compared with 21st percentile. First of all, there's no percentiles that state where were they prior to this. Had they grown? All we know is that the children who were read to scored higher, and the children who weren't scored lower. And so there's actually no comparison. What was the percentile before the intervention? What was the percentile after the intervention? And I'm sure it did increase. I'm just saying that the study did not indicate this information.
Ms. Farmer?
Yes.
Can I ask you to summarize? Because we have one more bill that we wanted to get to today.
Okay.
I would really appreciate that.
So, anyway, the Woodcock Reading Mastery Test was used to bring their scores, and that was the same one of the same tests that Project Optimize used, and their scores all exceeded benchmark. So it just shows the correct type of intervention will matter. The National Reading Panel did determine that there were five components that are absolutely critical to reading instruction: phonemic awareness, phonics instruction, oral reading, vocabulary, and comprehension. Those are the areas that tutoring needs to be focused on, not on reading aloud. I believe that a program like SMART would have the greatest impact if it were done in our preschools, and we spent our federal funds on appropriate methods of instruction that have been proven by research. I totally object to any federal dollars being used for the SMART program. Wonderful program, it's not a place for federal funds. And I would like to see that the training be done to the teachers. I have a license, right now it's expired, but I have a degree in education, and when I came up against my own dyslexic child, I was at a loss. I could not figure out how to teach my child, and that's how I got online and found out what I know. And I came up very much against teachers who were trying to say, no, we know the best way, and they were not. And today my child is in a charter school having research-based instruction because her school district would not provide her with an appropriate education. I have handouts. Most of what is in your packet are first pages of websites. There's an online book that is handout number, let's see, I'm sorry, Anyway, there's an online book there that is called Preventing Reading Difficulties. Susan Burns, I thought I had the page marked. I apologize. That's an online book. I encourage you to get in there and read it. I will be. I really apologize. I had these at home, and I do not have enough, but I can send them online to you. Put reading first. It talks about what reading instruction should have. National Reading Panel, totally. Those of you who are interested, I encourage you to really investigate. I would like to totally love to make myself available to try to work on education reform. It has been at my heart for a long time. Another thing I would like to quickly add is among the people that I believe are qualified to be tutors, should this bill move forward, there are very wonderful instructional assistants out there who have been taught how to teach children and are doing it very effectively. As a matter of fact, Project Optimize, many of the people who were working with those children were instructional assistants who were using an appropriate program. So I would like to see instructional assistants added to the tutoring list. And because even myself, having a degree, just because even a teacher has a license is not going to state that she is even going to give my child the right kind of instruction. One other quick thing. I do not know, in regards to the charter school issue, if there is another legislative law already existing that forbids this type of federal funds to go to charter schools. But if there is not, I would also object to this particular portion. My daughter attends a charter school, and I can tell you right now that paragraph B under Section 7 is not going to happen. The school district is not going to give her charter school any dollars, any more than they have to. So I would like to see the charter schools available to apply for that research themselves, or the research grants. I'm available for questions if you have any.
I'll just make a comment if I can.
Briefly.
I won't.
Okay.
I won't.
Thank you. I thank you for your time and your energy, and please do keep advocating for readers. It's our best source to have successful students. Thank you.
I do apologize that I did not have my information typed up. I would be happy if anyone would like to provide a transcript. If anyone would like to have one, would that be helpful?
Well, actually, we can get the copy of today's information from our IT department.
I didn't type up
department.
As your league, may I just say, I would love to talk with you sometime. As a dyslexic person who also went through a school system, I would love to talk to you about your child's experience and compare it to mine. So I understand the passion that you come with, and
yes,
I appreciate you being a mother that does that. So.
Thank you. It has been a long road. I just won a due process hearing against my school district as an unrepresented parent, and I am still having to advocate for her needs. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Roblin. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2615, and if John and Duncan and Sue, if you'd come forward, and then so at least you can speak to 2615, and then if we have time to have the full chalkboard panel give us any last thoughts and conclusions. I know we're about out of time. We have at least 10 minutes, no more than 14. Actually, 13. And if we can't do justice, I apologize.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Sue.
And members of the committee, my name is Sue Hildick. I'm the president of the Chalkboard Project, and we very much appreciate the time you've been devoting to hearing our bills, and thank you for this hearing regarding 2615. This is Chalkboard's proposal to create a per-student spending guarantee, and we're really eager to share it with you today. The previous three bills you heard focus on investments, efficiencies, and really maximizing and strengthening our teacher training across the state. Now we're turning to how do we fund those concepts. We all know that Oregon has one of the most unstable funding systems in the country, and what we are trying to achieve with this proposal is first and foremost stability. Secondly, we think it's a much more rational way to have the conversation around adequacy. I want to describe to you that this proposal came forward from a working group that Chalkboard convened around finance and accountability issues, and we were very honored when Jim Scherzinger agreed to chair that group. I want to put in the record a list of all the people who participated on that, as well as the executive summary of their findings. There were 48 recommendations that came out of that work, and they were all very strong, great recommendations. We had the difficult task of narrowing those down to the ones that we brought forward in this legislative session. I also want to say that this proposal works in concert with two other pieces that Chalkboard has. One is doubling the size of the state stability fund and undergirding our system. We think that's vital. We are among those groups who support dedicating the corporate kicker to that and filling it as rapidly as we can. I think I'm going to stop there and let Jim and John. John was also a member of the working group, and so was Duncan Wise. Duncan had to leave, but I know he'd be happy to offer thoughts at a later time about how the business plan sees this as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Scherzinger. I was chair of the finance work group for the Chalkboard Project. And in the handout, you'll see not only a list of the members of the finance work group, and you'll also see a summary of the conclusions that we came to. If you look at that, and I'm not going to talk about it, what you'll find is that we looked at everything with regard to funding, equity, efficiency, the formula, transparency, adequacy, all of those things. But what I've been asked to talk about today is simply why we came up with a spending-based or per-student cost formula as opposed to some other type of funding mechanism. And I think to, as quickly as possible, understand that.
Jim, can I interrupt? I hate rushing people, and so I'm really uncomfortable with having you to really narrow this down. Do you have suggestions for continuance or a possibility of continuance? This is your second or third day already here, but I'm afraid there's a lot of meat here we don't want to miss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a lot of meat, and we'd love the opportunity to take more time. I know that this coming Thursday would not work for our panel, but next Tuesday would if you decide to carry over the bills. And of course, we'd love an opportunity to respond to the suggestions
right.
that have been made on the others as well.
Exactly. So there's several things that we haven't had an opportunity to bring conclusion. So my preference would be to take about the next 5 minutes and just maybe give us, Jim, a little bit of an overview so we can study it, and then plan on you coming back next Tuesday.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. And this, I think, would be quick, and it is, I think, what I planned was sort of a quick overview on this, is that I think the place you have to begin with our work group is that we were asked to come up with funding suggestions for a system that was outcomes-based. In other words, Well, in order to have an outcomes-based system, you need fundamentally two things. You need to know what outcomes you want, which presumably a legislative body or some other body would set. And secondly, you have to have some understanding of what actions it takes to achieve those outcomes. And often that's called best practice. You have to have some sense of what best practices are. And when you have those two things, when you clearly understand what outcomes you want and what actions it takes to produce those outcomes, you could then, on the financial side, tie dollars to those specific actions and say, if you funded those kinds of actions, that you would achieve the goals that you have. So you, if we're asked to come up with a funding mechanism for an outcomes-based system, that's sort of the logic or the way that you would tie a concept of funding in an outcomes-based system. So as we looked at the approaches that have been taken, and by and large in the past we've looked at revenue-based systems Most of the time, it's sort of like you spend the revenue you have or you don't have, whatever the case may be, and that's the funding mechanism. But there have been other approaches, and we examined other formula-based systems, usually tied to revenue, about how you would fund the system, and we ended up saying, you know, fairly straightforwardly, that if what you really wanted was an outcomes-based system, then you had to define the outcomes. You had to define, at least in some sense, what you believe best practices to be, and then tie the funding to what is the cost to make that happen. And that's, I think, in a very short summary, why we came up with what you might call a spending-based formula. Now, having said that, I think there are two caveats that I would draw. And the first of them is that when we looked at this, we looked at the whole package. It's not just having a spending-based structure that's important, but it's the whole package around equity and efficiency and transparency in particular. You have to have a lot of transparency about what results you're getting and what mechanisms are being used to get to those results. And the second thing is that there's a lot more to this than just finances. That getting the outcomes you want is not simply a financial question. There is a whole question of accountability, of how are you going to hold the system accountable, a school district accountable, a school accountable for the results that you want. And that's a whole separate question. The whole system can't be micromanaged from above, especially a system as large as this one. And so that question of how accountability for outcomes happens is a whole significant question that needs to be integrated. You can use the, and so the whole point of it is that it's more than financial. And I know that's obvious, but in some ways, but I think it's important in the way that we looked at it. So we said, yes, we believe that a spending-based system is consistent with the goal that we've been given. But you have to look at the whole package, and you have to have a clear discussion about accountability as part of that. So that's a very fast summary of what a lot of work that my committee members did, and I thank them for that.
Jim, we were handed three different documents. The expenditure, was that your part, John?
Yes.
Okay, and so you want to wait till next week to present that? Okay. And then we have this, the white page.
I believe there's a white page, which is the membership of both. There was an education work group.
With blue papers.
Right, and a finance work group.
Okay.
And then the summary of the finance work group's conclusion is the yellow sheets. And the education quality, educator quality group was the blue pages.
Thank you for sharing what we have in our hands. Okay. Yes, Representative Roblin and then Dahlem, please.
Oh, Representative Dahlem first.
Oh. Are you absolutely certain? This is the first time I've ever had the literature with an opportunity to read it. There'd be a lot of questions when we come back.
That's true.
Thanks, Representative Dahlem. Representative Roblin.
I just wanted to, if it was okay with you, ask a question of some of the people who are here. We've got an extra week here,
we do have a couple bills on Thursday.
I know, but I'm just talking about these groups of people who are amassed here. And this is my personal one. One of the deals has to do with the collaborative. And I've talked to people with OEA, I've talked to people from Chalkboard, and I would really like our committee to encourage, maybe even more than encourage, the groups to get together, because what I hear from both of them is they both like some of the ideas, but they haven't figured out what, but I haven't figured out what that whole thing is. Having, you know, the whole group that was up there have a group meet with Chalkboard is fine with me. I put as many people as we can into it. I would really love to have, you know, come out of this session personally. The opportunity to have real research and staff development. I think our last person spoke to it as well, that, you know, having the tools in the hands of our teachers and getting the best tools there is really what's going to make the difference, in my opinion, in the long run with respect to accountability. We have outstanding teachers, and if they have the tools, they do outstanding work. And finding those and having an organization that gets that to them is really important to me, and administrators, and classified as well, because I agree that when it comes to tutoring, they have to have those things. So having those discussions between now and then, and maybe having them come up with something, would be, for me, really important. And having our committee tell that group to get together and talk to each other, which I think, from my discussions, they would really like to do, to come to some kind of real conclusion, would be really helpful. And they could start now, and if they get something to work, I would really appreciate it. Because there's some great minds out there.
For a clarification of process, that would be the interested parties working together without any legislative representation.
We don't have to have any representation. They can do that. I trust the groups. I mean, I really do. I think they have some great ideas, and from my understanding, everybody would like to get something together. But I mean, I don't know what will happen of it. But
okay.
Madam Chair, we would welcome that opportunity, and we would look forward to those conversations. I just wanted to bring to your attention, you know, on this list are the work group participants around teacher quality that came up with the idea for the collaborative. And if you look at that list, you'll see all the stakeholders represented, two OEA reps and one from most of the other groups. The public and private colleges were represented. What we did with that group was we closed the door, and we said, you're protected from the media and from everybody else, and without the pressures, if Oregon was dreaming about what we need to do for educators, what would it look like? And then we took the results from that, and we've tried to craft it into a bill, imperfectly, I would say. And so there's lots of room to bring that together. But I just want you to understand where it came from. It's not something we dreamed up, but really a group of Oregonians saying this is the thing we ought to consider.
Well, and what I see in everybody that's in this room, there isn't one of us that isn't here because we're not passionate about education and the future for Oregon. And so I appreciate that, and I support the concept completely if some of the partners are willing to get together and have a cup of coffee, and I wish we didn't have to be on camera all the time either. But if you could work together, that'd be wonderful.
How would it be best to get that?
I don't know.
Talk to me or whatever. I'll do whatever I can to help encourage you.
You're going to help coordinate this?
I will do whatever I need to do to help coordinate it, yes.
And Madam Chair, we'd be happy to take the lead in coordinating it as well.
Okay. And you'll assist when needed?
Whenever they want.
Thank you, Representative Roblin.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2612, 2613, 2614, and 2615. And we adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair.